Oh, I tell you, where's the grandma this far? Hello, Tessa.
Who else needs yellow papers?
There you go.
What are we doing with this? I'll tell you what we're going to do with this.
Writing helps you remember things. So you're going to write the normal blood concentration. Now, somebody asked what that question mark was. That's a web mess up because it was to the minus one, right? It's millimoles per liter, right, on that. It's just a web. On the ion concentration, that was just a little mess up on the thing. It's per liter, right? Millimoles per liter anyway. So sodium, write down on your yellow piece of paper, what is sodium concentration in your blood? Right, 3.5 to 5.0. And the next one, and potassium is very critical, right? Because if it's too low, you got problems. If it's too high, you got problems, right? Goes too high, you're dead. Goes too low, what happens? You're dead. It's a real critical balance there. Chloride, 95 to 105. Millimoles per liter, right? And then pH. 7.35 to 7.45, right. And the next one, whatever that is. What is that one? That's peak, yeah. Partial pressure of CO2, which is 35 to 45, right? And then we have bicarb. This is in your blood. 22 to 26 milliequivalents per liter. And there's some yellow papers back there. If you want to grab one, go back to the table. We're writing down these values. So that's what's normal. In some textbooks, I just put that in there. They might list 21 to 28 for the bicarb. So that is for you all to try to remember. Right? You find a little piece. Writing it down, I know it seems so silly, right? Writing it down will help you remember it. Okay. We got it down? Could you close your eyes and remember that? Now, what's some useful ways to remember this we've told you, kind of hinted about?
35-45.
Yeah, 35-45, right? On the sodium. Look at potassium. 35 to 5, so maybe think 45 but add a 5, whatever you want to do, right? 35 to 5. Chloride's a little harder to remember. pH, pretty easy to remember, right? 35 to 45 because of the sodium. PCO2, hey, that's pretty good, isn't it? You'd think that somebody just created these values just so you could remember it easier. 35 to 45. And bicarb. You might think, well, that's a little hard, but bicarb is regulated by what, generally? Metabolic is your kidneys, right? Kidneys. So how many kidneys do you have?
Two.
Isn't that great? So two. Start off with two. Two plus two is four. You do that twice because it's bicarb, so then you get what? Six. Right? Hey, how about that? Two, two, two. And a six. The sodium?
Partial pressure.
Oh, yes, it's partial pressure. Well, yeah, you don't have to worry about the units in that sense. The partial pressure, usually we take that as 35, 45, but yes, it's a kind of a way to work on it. And You've already got it memorized, I'm sure.
We're writing down these wonderful values that are on the
website. Okay. So you got that down. All right. So you can remember that. Hypnosis. You've got it down. Easy way to remember it. All right. But those kind of values you want to know for yourself, too. If anybody works in the healthcare and they run a, say, the respiratory therapist does an arterial stick, for example, or a venous stick, and you get those values, they put it into a machine, it pops it out, it will give like a little star or something, or arrows being high or low, if somebody's blood is too high or too low in any of these values. Okay, so that's something to remember. Good. So the goal today is we're going to get through this respiratory relatively quick and get on to some other things. So we left off here, right, with the bore effect and the root effect. There's one other effect we're going to talk about a little bit. There's three major effects or terms we should remember with these. But you should know a right shift or a left shift in the oxygen disassociation curve means what? If it's a rightward shift, did it increase or decrease affinity?
Decrease
affinity, right. If it's a leftward shift, it increases affinity. And the way you do that is just take one PO2 value, go up, and you can see the percent saturation. So the root effect is decreased total content of oxygen. The Bohr effect is this left-right shift, generally. And then there's one other one we'll talk about here in a minute. Is, let's see, my thing's acting crazy. Oh, yeah. Is this Haldane effect. And this is another part about deoxygenated hemoglobin picks up CO2 and hydrogen ion. So deoxygenated, without oxygenation, it can actually pick up more CO2. So that's part of something that's interesting. Hemoglobin itself can be a buffer. It picks up hydrogen ion. So hemoglobin itself can be a buffer as well in the body. So that's pretty neat to think about. But CO2, majority of CO2 is not carried in the blood as gas. It's converted into bicarb. The majority of your CO2 is carried by bicarb. So only about 5-10% CO2 in your blood from muscles working and the byproduct, remember, right, is it's converted quickly to bicarb by your favorite enzyme,
carbonic
anhydrase. One of the fastest, but not the fastest, but very fast, millionfold increase in speed of reaction. And we'll convert it to either hydrogen and bicarb, or it goes the other way. So the enzyme works bidirectional, right? Either direction, just whichever way is favored. And if you have hemoglobin with CO2 bound to it, it's called carbonic and hemoglobin. So that's CO2 binding with hemoglobin. Okay, so carbonic anhydrase, we'll talk a little bit more about it, but remember, it's in your lungs, it's in your red blood cells, and like on the fish that we talked about, for gas exchange across the gills, it's on the gills as well. But you have it in other tissues as well in your body. As far as we know, every organism, living animal, has carbonic anhydrase in it, because it's everybody that's checked so far, at least they've found it in there, it's pretty neat. But you have different isoforms, right? Different isoforms. All right, so this other part has appeared on standardized exams called the chloride shift. So let's go over a little bit of that. And it's interesting, but it's very straightforward. You don't have to memorize. It's just, it fits. Just think of exercising skeletal muscle or the lungs. Just keep those two tissues in mind. So what happens in exercising skeletal muscle? You get extra byproduct of CO2, right, from breakdown of glucose. So if you have CO2, it dissolves, goes right across by lipid membranes, goes into the red blood cell. What happens in the red blood cell? This is where you have carbonic anhydrase, right? So it's inside of the red blood cell, CA, carbonic anhydrase, and it quickly can convert this to bicarb and hydrogen ion. The bicarb is building up inside the red blood cell, and it can actually then be taken out of the red blood cell to keep the reaction going this way, right? Keep the reaction going this way. And the way this happens is to have it with an antiporter to chloride. So chloride from the blood will go into the red blood cell. So this is what's referred to as this chloride shift. For some reason, standardized exams on MCAT and dental exams like to mention which way does the chloride shift go in, say, the lungs or exercising tissue.
So if you produce bicarb, then it's really easy to remember that bicarb is going to go out and chloride is going to go in. But what happens in the lungs? You're going to be blowing out CO2, right? So you need to make CO2 and get rid of that bicarb. And the way you do that is to reverse this, because it's just an antiporter. It's not energy dependent, it's just an antiporter. So bicarb will go in, convert back to CO2. CO2 can dissolve right through the bilipid membrane and then out the lungs, because it's like a sink, right? You're always blowing off CO2, right? You know, you just keep breathing and you're blowing it off. Remember, that's the way you lose weight too, right? We talked about that, you know, lipid breakdowns. Where does that weight go if it's not in the water? CO2, it's actually weighs something, right? So CO2 dissolves off. So the chloride shift is which direction in the lungs? Chloride goes in or out of the red blood cell, right? The opposite of the bicarb. So those are the things to remember for those crazy standardized exams. But it is pretty neat that it's always a driving gradient. It's whatever the sink is, right? If you're pulling bicarb into the blood, then you can get the reaction that way. If you're blowing off CO2, the whole reaction goes the other way. And you can kind of see, too, about what we just talked about, carbonic hemoglobin with CO2 bound to it. And it can actually buffer pH as well inside the cell. So old exams had a question. We had somebody email this weekend. Why was it again we needed red blood cells? Kind of just a general thought question. What do we need? Why can't we just have hemoglobin floating out in the blood and the plasma?
Well, it makes the blood very thin, like viscous, mm-hmm. and so it won't flow as fast as it needs to get what it needs. It's
right.
Less efficient.
You're right. It's going to raise osmolarity, less efficient. But having everything packaged together, right, with the enzyme in hemoglobin, then you have all those reactions taking place right there in the pH changes right there, right? And so it makes it really efficient to have everything with the carbonic anhydrase right inside the RBC as well. And then all that's in the hemoglobin stored right here that's sensitive to pH as well, right? We talked about the pH shift, right, the Bohr shift. So the Bohr shift could go right or left. Which way would it go with lower pH? The Bohr shift goes to the right or to the left with lower pH?
Right.
Less efficient, right? Less affinity. So those are things to, you know, keep in mind. I know some of it's memory, but we just got to kind of keep going. Sometimes people ask, what does hypercapnia mean? Capnia is CO2. So CO2 or hypo, you know, low. Capnia is low CO2. So just to kind of remember those terms, capnic, if you're hypercapnic, means you're not breathing out. So if you're not breathing out, what happens to CO2 in your body? It builds up and your pH goes down. Right, exactly. So that's what to remember there. And then there's different terms for hypoxia, like hypoxic hypoxia, high altitude, you know, you're not getting the oxygen in. Anemic hypoxia, we talked about that before. How could that happen, for example, besides carbon monoxide poisoning?
Iron deficiency.
Pardon?
Iron deficiency.
Iron deficiency, possibly. Another one, which relates to RBCs, right? Where are RBCs made? Bone marrow. So maybe you have a lot of damage in your bone, on bones, right? Like a car accident, you can have problems. They have to watch out for that, especially ribs, older people. And what about other things? How about if your kidneys are failing? Why would that relate to kidneys? Kidneys, how do kidneys relate with blood? Am I off on a crazy tangent again?
Filter blood.
Pardon?
Filter blood.
Not so much filter. They make something really important. Erythropoietin, right, which then goes through red blood cells to make RBCs, right? So kind of keep all these things together. So now's this time to really start integrating all this physiology in such a short time, 2 more weeks. It's hard, I know. Okay, so these are things to think about. And we talked about like cyanide poisoning a long time ago, the beginning of the course. Where does it hit to for poisoning your body? Does anybody remember? Right, the respiratory chain, right, and the electron transport chain. It can actually inhibit this as well, so then you have a problem. But we don't have to memorize exactly which part of the electron transport chain, just that it hits the electron transport chain. Okay, and so just to kind of put this in context too, is if you breathe more, right, start breathing, you're all excited about the quiz, well, you're going to get more oxygen in your body, but what's going to happen to your CO2 level? You're going to blow it out. And so what's going to happen to your pH? It's going to increase. And what do we call that? If you're breathing and your pH drops, your pH goes up, but the hydrogen ion drops, right? What was that for? What do we call it? If it becomes greater than 7.45, what are we in? We're in alkalosis. If it goes below 7.35, what are we in? Acidosis. So respiratory all has to do with CO2. Think of that. CO2 is respiratory. Kidneys, the 2, 2, 2, and 6, right, is your bicarb. Right? So bicarb values, think of kidney. CO2 values, think of lungs. So we would be, if we kept breathing really fast, you're all hyperventilating, CO2 blows off, pH goes up, you're in respiratory alkalosis, right? You stop breathing, you want to hold your breath, you're going to be in respiratory acidosis, okay? So those are the things to remember with this. And just to help remind you about that, I think I've pulled it up here on the web somewhere. These little things, I have a little site right here on your webpage. You can click on that, and this pops up. And this is really neat. So you can do these yourselves. There's lots of free web pages with these types of ABG gases. And you can then try to guess what's happening. Well, let's look at this one. 7.56. Are we in acidosis or alkalosis?
Alkalosis.
Now, is CO2 in the normal range or a high range?
Low.
CO2? What was the range we wanted in there? 35, 45. So it's low. So what does that mean?
Respiratory.
You're breathing it out, right? And you breathe it out really fast? Then, is your bicarb in the normal range?
Yes.
Right. So that's okay. So what do we call this?
Respiratory alkalosis.
Yes. Very good. All right. So what gets a little bit confusing sometimes is down on some of these others. If we look at down here, what happened here? This is alkalotic or acidic? 7.48, right? So it's alkalotic. So you would think, okay, so did I breathe out too fast? Is my CO2, low, for example? Right? But then, if I'm trying to balance my bicarb and get my pH back to normal, what's happening here? Is bicarb high or low? So what is this now? This is abnormal. You would think if you had low bicarb, something's odd with this situation. It's not just matching. First two things to always look at is pH and CO2. So what do you think this is? So is it trying to compensate in some way? So if we pick this, partially compensated, it's trying to compensate for this alkalosis by reducing the bicarb. You are alkalotic. So the body's thinking, okay, and your CO2 is already low, so you're like hyperventilating. But then your body's like, hey, I'm too alkalotic. I need to get rid of some bicarb. So your kidneys are kicking in over time, and you're getting rid of excess bicarb. But normally, let's say CO2 was normal here, this would be really odd, wouldn't it? The bicarb being low and a high pH, right? So then you know already it's something to do with compensation. So the first two things on any of these kind of questions, and these have appeared on standardized exams, and if you take 412G, human physiology, or any other physiology course, usually they'll give you ones that are compensated, and it kind of like confuses you. But first look at the pH and the CO2, and then if that doesn't make sense, then there's something going on with the bicarb usually. So I think that might help. So there's a lot of free websites for these kind of things. All right, so, you could check those out. All right, so I think we were, yeah. So there's not much more on respiratory. It's kind of like redone what we've just talked about. But there are some really neat aspects about how the body compensates for, like in your lungs. If there's low O2, you might think this is kind of odd. If there's low O2 in the
circulatory system is going to the lungs, it actually vasoconstriction. You think, oh, wow, that like decreases more blood flow. Isn't that weird? But it raises the pressure so you can start to perfuse parts of the lung that will get good oxygenation. So it's a way to kind of think about it. There's this shunting effect in your lungs that can actually try to get oxygen going to places where it's going to, maybe you have to raise blood pressure to get there, but that it'll help in the overall to increase perfusion to places where you couldn't get good oxygenation. So I know that's a little bit odd. And some of these other things we don't have to worry about. You don't have to worry about exactly which muscles in the insect that are working to close spiracles, but we did talk about spiracles being important for insects with respiration. All right. These diagrams are just kind of nice to look through for you to get an idea of what's balancing blood flow, but just like we just talked about already. And if you're exercised, what happens? Most of the time when you're standing here just now, you're only perfusing the bottom part of your lungs. But if you start to exercise and raise blood pressure and heart rate goes up, then you start to perfuse the upper part of your lungs. Right now, the pressure is high around the lower part for the blood vessels coming in, right, the blood pressure, so you can perfuse those really well. But as you try to go higher, what's happening? It's not being able to open up those little capillary beds very well, the arterial beds right there. So you're not perfusing very much of your upper lungs. But if you start to exercise, increase your blood pressure, increase your heart rate, and then you start to perfuse the rest of your lungs. And that's how you get more oxygenation. If you're perfusing the whole amount of your lungs all the time, and you just sped it up going through, what's going to happen? You're not going to have enough time to pull oxygen into your blood, right, and get rid of the CO2. So you just don't want to speed it up through there. You want to perfuse more of it. So this is, we have a lot of our lungs that's just in reserve, not really contributing that much to oxygenation until you exercise, all right? And then you start to perfuse the rest of it. If you're laying down, perfuse, you know, pretty much evenly, right? It's just the pressure difference. So that's the main thing to think about. Now, we don't want to go through all these different spots on the respiratory structures in the brainstem, but the main point to remember here is that you do have respiratory structures in your brainstem. You don't have to memorize which groups or anything like that for this class. But it's really quite neat because, and this diagram doesn't do it complete justice, some of this respiratory group is right underneath the fourth ventricle here. These are those places that make cerebral spinal fluid, right? Remember those brains we showed you, the two holes in the left and right hemispheres? And they come together, make the third, and it drains into the fourth. Right underneath the fourth ventricle is where the cells are that can actually even detect the pH. And so it's kind of interesting. You have spots in your brain that can actually detect respiration pH levels. So that's kind of neat, too. But your whole respiratory drive is in this brainstem region. It doesn't matter if you looked in your brain, a bird brain, a lizard brain, a salamander brain. The brainstem is all organized the same way, with different regions being the same. So that brainstem is very fundamental across all vertebrates. So it's pretty neat to think about that you could go in there and know exactly which spots are respiratory structures or other spots, like what we talked about with hormones in the hypothalamus, for example. So that's the main thing. Don't all freak out with all the different parts of it. Just that there's parts in your brain that control your breathing, and you don't have to think about it, right? You might put the headphones on, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. You're just doing it automatically. But if you have a stroke or something, think about that part in the brain. I mean, you can lose big chunks of your brain, the cortex, right? But if you lost some spot in your brainstem, a little blood vessel that clogs up there and kills that spot out, you're in deep doo-doo, right? Just the tiniest little spot, like the point on your pencil, could be life-death. But another spot, you can take out chunks, and it wouldn't really be that bad. So it really depends where. But that brainstem, you need your brainstem. All right, so you know that this is going to go to the diaphragm and increase your breathing. All right, so that's the main point. And we've talked about this over and over again, the difference of aortic bodies, carotid sinuses, right, for pressure, carotid bodies for CO2, pH, but aortic bodies as well. These bodies can also detect low O2, but mainly, right now, in humans, it's mostly pH and CO2. You can put those two together, like pH, CO2, right? But if those are not working well, then it's really oxygen, hypoxia, that you detect. Okay, so we've kind of gone through all that, and we've talked about these differences.
Okay, so we've got through, I don't know, I just, little thing that they gave us just steps through everything. All right, so here's some fun things that are not in your book, but we've talked about, I mean, not in other books. But we need to talk about sympathetic system, right? That causes vaso, what, to your bronchi? Dilation, right? So you can breathe in and out better. And, of course, it's going to increase your heart rate. So it's like running from that bear, right? Now, here's some things that might just be helpful. I kind of put these in here. And I know some people ask about what these things mean. This is like diabetic ketoacidosis. IV is IV, you know, things like that. Okay, so it's just to remember your kidneys and lungs. So anything with bicarb, think of kidneys. CO2, lungs. All right, so this is a way to remember that, and that wonderful reaction. We should get a tattoo for it. You can really mess up your pH in your body by taking too many antacids, for example. What's going to happen? You take all that bicarb in your stomach, what's going to happen? Well, you think you might become alkalotic, right? Initially, like the bicarb's going into your blood. But really what's happening is you're pulling hydrogen to buffer that. And so you just keep pulling out hydrogen to try to buffer that bicarb. And then you've pulled out that hydrogen, so you become alkalotic, right? So it's kind of interesting to think about problems that can happen. And just bicarb, remember those values that we talked about. If you go up or lower, it's metabolic acidosis or alkalosis. All right, and we talked about respiratory compensation. So, just another term to try to think about that. You know, you're low on the, you're getting, if you go low on the pH, below 7.35, think acidosis already, and then you start to look at the pH, the PCO2, this is arterial. That's just in case you, a big A in the literature means alveolar, you know, and a little A here like arterial or venous, right? So if you go above the 45 or you lower than 45, then you're out of that, or if you lower than 35, right, you're then out of that range. So if you're greater than 45, you know you're holding on to CO2, and then you're going to have a problem, right? And bicarb, if it's compensated, like maybe above 2.26, then you know you're compensated. So is the bicarb in the normal value, or is it high or low? Compared to that pH, does it go the opposite direction of what you would think? If it's lower than 7.35, you know you're acidotic. But if this is higher than 26, that kind of doesn't make sense, right? This needs to be basic. So you know it's probably compensated, right? So just, you know, try to keep that straight. It's not too bad. Okay, and there's lots of different reasons that you can have these. I just put these up, stole them from some other PowerPoint, so you could see this. So it's just, again, the same kind of problems. But you can see that you hyperventilate. When you get super excited, people pass out, right? Or if you hold your breath, you're going to pass out, right? Either way, you can pass out from acidosis or alkalosis. So it's kind of interesting. People breathe in bags sometimes, like when you get excited. Why does that calm people down? Like, I don't know if you've maybe had classmates or maybe yourself. I don't want to know. But, you know, you might have been told to breathe in the bag if you get too excited. I took a bunch of middle school kids once to a science meeting, and this kid started blowing a paper bag in the back, scared the living daylights out of me because I was driving the van, the adult on this van with like 10 middle school kids. I was like, what in the hell is going on? You know, and so we had to pull over on the road, and yeah, he gets excited. He was excited for the science fair thing. Anyways, I was ready to strangle a parent for not telling me this thing. So I learned a lesson very quickly about this situation. Okay, alkalosis, we know just the other thing. Basic, right? So you can think about compensated too, would be lower than 22 if he's trying to compensate that alkalosis, getting rid of the bicarb. All right, there's lots of reasons. Oh, this is a good one too to think about. Acid overdoses is a real problem with that, like people taking too many aspirins or salicylic compounds, you know, aspirins. Okay. All right, so we've kind of talked about this already. Bicarb, metabolic, kidneys, right? And metabolic alkalosis, right, fits well. Right, this is high. pH is high. If PCO2 is normal, then it's not compensated. But if these are high and that's high, then you know that's fitting, right? pH and alkalosis. So it could be trying to compensate by altering your breathing rate and changing your CO2 in that way. Okay, so just things to think about. So you should know these ABCs. We wrote them down. ABGs, I mean. Arterial blood gases, for example. All right. And the other thing to put in there is potassium. Potassium, what's the range of potassium again? Check your yellow sheets. All right, good. All right. So really important. Okay, so let's do a little bit of some other stuff, like osmoregulation. Now, I don't know if you've got the textbook or another one that's fine too, but there's a lot in osmoregulation. And we could spend the whole time just like on amphibians if we wanted to, right? The whole class. So the main points, this is what I'm going to try to cover, the main points in a short period of time, but we need to make sure we understand some of it on comparative aspects, but we'll hit pretty hard on the mammalian kidneys, all right? Don't try to memorize tables, but understand the general take-home. If you're an invertebrate in salt water, what do you want to do with osmoregulation? You want to balance your osmolarity, right? You want to balance your sodium, potassium. We know how important it is for your resting membrane potential of your cells, right, with potassium. And we know how important it is if you raise your osmolarity, like you're dehydrated, what's going to happen to your red blood cells? If you're dehydrated, your osmolarity is high in your blood, but your RBC is floating in that blood, right? What's going to happen to it? The osmolarity is really high out here. It's going to shrink. And if you drink a lot of water, and what would happen if it's hypoosmotic compared to the red blood cells? It's going to swell, right? And your brain detects that too. All your cells in your body. So it's really important to keep that osmolarity at some balance. So this is what we're talking about when we talk about osmoregulation. Keeping all those cells healthy, and those cells can detect that, like in your body, like in your hypothalamus, from swelling or shrinking by activating your favorite types of proteins in your neurons. How do you detect touch? Stretch activated ion channels. The same idea if a cell swells or shrinks, right? So it's the same kind of concept to think about. All right, so invertebrates in salt water, their extracellular fluid is very similar to salt water. That's pretty neat. And that was very helpful in the late 1940s and 50s, because when the gods of biology and physiology were working on squid preps and invertebrate preps, they were able to just take seawater and put that into the bathing, into their little container that they're measuring the activity or the membrane potential of squid axons or invertebrate cells. So they just used seawater as a saline. And they're kind of lucky because that seawater kept those preparations alive. But it tells you, again, that that extracellular solution is very similar to seawater. All right, so you can look up here and you can see seawater across here, 460 millimole of sodium. Let's look at the, you know, starfish, jellyfish. Where's the squid? Squid, you know, 419. Aplysia, sea slug, 492, a little higher. But generally in that range, very high osmolarity. Now, if you go to freshwater invertebrates, let's say a freshwater invertebrate or terrestrial, or freshwater here, we should have our favorite animal, crayfish, there we go. You see that that's really low, 146, right? And 146, well, that's pretty neat. That's pretty low. And then if you look at terrestrial invertebrates, like a cockroach or a locust, look at the locust is really low. But the cockroach is quite low compared to seawater, too. And if we switch over to the other table here, we think about humans, Homo sapiens, 142. So we're very similar to, say, the invertebrates that are freshwater or the invertebrates that are terrestrial in some ways. I mean, in the sense of very low sodium. And chloride matches the same, pretty much the same way. Seawater's high, seawater invertebrates high. Terrestrial insects in invertebrates in freshwater are low. And the same like amphibians. So amphibians are very much like us. So you see the frog here, low in sodium, low in chloride compared to seawater or compared to seawater invertebrates. So the take home here is you get the idea, terrestrial insects, amphibians, mammals, pretty much in the same group, seawater invertebrates, high like seawater. Right? Okay, so that's all you have to memorize. That's not so bad, right? That's not so bad. Okay, that's easy. All right, and we just went through what we needed to know about what's in us, right, for, say, blood. I would try to test you differently about interstitial fluid versus the serum, but mainly, you know, the serum is what you would measure in things. Intercellular fluid, we know what's high in inside cells. What's high inside the cell, generally? Potassium, right? Potassium is high inside the cell. So what happens if you damage, you know, you smash your muscle, your big muscle on your leg, right? The cinder block, what's going to happen? Potassium spills out, right? Goes into your bloodstream, causes you arrhythmias, can damage other cells around that damaged site, right? Because of potassium spilling out. So it's not that cell that might be damaged, but the neighboring cells are damaged from that high potassium. Then what else is inside cells? About half the weight inside of a cell. What else is inside cells? Nothing. Bag of jelly. Proteins, right? About half the weight of a cell is protein. So now those proteins spill out in your blood. What's that going to do? And somebody had mentioned that. What's the problem with osmolarity, right? It's going to change osmolarity, right? Because the proteins go high. But not only that, it's going to clog up your glomerulus, your kidney, right? So you can't make urine and can't filter that. And so now you got a problem with acute renal failure, right? So high protein in your blood is not great. All right, so from damaged cells. The idea about how you lose water, because when we talk about osmolarity, we've got to talk about water, right? It goes together, dilution or concentration. Might not be a change in the ions, but it's a change in the water that it's diluted in. So if you lose too much water, then you become hyperosmotic, right? So you evaporate quite a bit of water in a dry room. You lose most of your water. Either if you're exercising, perspiration, right? But some salt comes out too in your sweat. But through your lungs, you can lose a lot of moisture. This is kind of interesting to look at, like the body weight and evaporative loss in animals. You can imagine a small little animal with a small surface area. I mean, a large surface area to body volume. They have this big surface area to that small volume. They can lose moisture quite quickly. Whereas a bigger animal has a bigger volume, smaller surface area. So it all goes back to that surface area to volume ratio. So the main points here are just to kind of think about that. And water loss, it usually animals are very good about retaining water. But look at like an amphibian that, you know, needs to be in a moist environment, right? Because they're respiring across their skin. Remember that? And they need a moist environment for that respiratory structure to really work well. But other animals, like, you know, of reptiles or something that's living in the desert, it's pretty good about not losing water through respiration. But look at us. We can lose quite a bit through respiration in the lungs. So if we're just breathing out in a hot, dry environment, you really lose quite a bit of water. Okay. So that's the main point there. And it's kind of interesting with insects. You've heard of, you know, that cockroaches will survive if we have a nuclear fallout or whatever. But it's kind of interesting that if you heat a cockroach up or insects up, you start to melt that waxy layer, and they can start to dehydrate very quickly. So it's that waxy layer that really keeps that moisture in. But as soon as that melts, they can lose quite a bit of moisture across their body. So that prevents them from losing that moisture. Now, if we go back to how do you gain water or how can you make water, or how do some animals like that desert kangaroo rat, which I have up here somewhere, this little guy, can survive without really drinking water? We talked about that. What's that water called again?
Metabolic
water. Exactly. So you get water from the breakdown of carbohydrates, fats, and proteins. But look how much metabolic water you gain from these different substances. Per gram of food, you get a lot of water from fat breakdown. That's pretty neat, right? So it might be not a bad storage substance for that desert kangaroo rat in time of plenty. The thing to think about on the energetics is that it takes energy to make fat, right? So if the energy is plentiful, it can then store it as fat and then use it, you know, to make ATP, but then it can also use it for the water, right? But it's going to take energy to store that fat. But in time of plenty, that's a good storage molecule. Plus, we remember, to store fat doesn't take water around it, right? So now you can decrease your body weight also by storing fat, like for the migratory bird, right? Or glycogen instead of glucose. So all that kind of fits together. So those are the things to remember there. And we just talked about water loss like with in breathing in and out in a dry environment or moist environment. But we can regain some in our mouth, right, because we're breathing out and it kind of condensates, if you will, in your respiratory structure, and then you save that water and it can regain. So we're not just losing it all to the environment from our moist lungs. So we can regain some, and that's thought that some ideas of maybe a long nose, even in some animals, might be helpful, like the dog, because you could regain more water. These kind of tables that are in, it doesn't matter which text you might be looking at in osmoregulation, they can be a little confusing about osmolarity. You always have to think about in reference to what, right? So is it hyperosmotic or hypoosmotic in reference to what? So are we talking about the cells in respect to the blood to interstitial fluid? Are we talking about the environment to the animal? So always in reference to what? So if you just say it's hyperosmotic, well, what does that mean? Seawater is hyperosmotic to the freshwater amphibian, right? But then the blood inside the animal might be hyperosmotic to the red blood cell, right? So we have to always think of it in terms of what? So this is what they're trying to do here in this table, urine concentration to the blood. Can it make a hyperosmotic urine to the blood, for example? How efficient can a kidney reabsorb water and get rid of, say, excess salts? Can it do that? Now think about just, you know, you don't have to memorize a lot. You just think about it. If a frog is put into fresh water, what's the problem? Fresh water, let's just think about it in extreme. Fresh water has low salts. So what's the problem with the frog? The salts want to go into that big pond, right? That freshwater pond. So what's going to happen? The pond is hypoosmotic to the frog, or the frog is hyperosmotic to the water. See, it goes either way. It depends how you reference it. So the problem is it's going to be losing salts. So what does the frog want to do? Prevent that loss, right? Maybe try to keep salts in. It sure doesn't want to excrete them out. But now if you take that frog and you put it in salt water, there's a problem, right? Because now the salt water is hyperosmotic to the frog. And the water is going to go out of the frog, right? It's going to shrink it down. Well, what about an animal that's in the salt water that is drinking salt water? That's a big problem, right? Unless you're a squid, maybe, right? Because your extracellular solution is about that. But if you're a bird, like we're going to reference here, which is much like a terrestrial insect or an amphibian or us for its osmoregulation, if it drinks seawater, what's the problem? The seawater is hyperosmotic to its body, right? So the seawater, just like us, goes inside of our GI tract. What's going to happen? It's going to pull water into the GI tract, right? And then what happens? You dehydrate. This is why if you're on a boat and you're out in the ocean, crazy, anybody in the ocean in a little boat, because you get seasick, it's horrible. I hate oceans. But anyways, because I get seasick so quickly, easily. What's going to happen? You definitely don't want to be drinking the water if you're out of water, right? And you're thirsty, unless you just want to commit Harry Carey and get it over with as quickly as possible. But that might not be good because you might get rescued, right? So you don't want to drink that water no matter what. Because what's going to happen is it's going to pull water out of your body and dehydrate you faster and you're going to die quicker. So just don't drink the water. What do? It tells you this in survival things. I know it's gross. Hint, hint, it's gross. Drink your urine, right? Save your urine. Because you can actually concentrate that over and over again, and you can survive multiple days by doing that. So that's not... I know it's gross, but if it saves your life, it might be better. Okay, so how can a bird... So for a human, we will die if we drink seawater, if we drink too much of it. But a bird can actually survive drinking the seawater because they have this great ability to excrete excess salt. And they can do this in these salt glands that they have in their nose, up by their nose. Well, we'll die, but let's see. I think I have a picture. No, I don't have a picture anymore. But they have these salt glands right by their beak, and you might see these seagulls with salt crystals coming down their beak. And it's because they can excrete the salt. I think it was in past years, I used to talk about the salt gland in more detail, but just for us, just remember that they have a salt gland and they can excrete excess salt, so their urine will only be about 3% salt. And
their nasal fluid can excrete more so they don't die, basically, right? But we can't do that. We don't have that ability. So seagulls are better at it than we are, right? And they can excrete that excess salt. Okay. Us, very bad. Not good. All right, we will die a lot quicker by drinking seawater. Okay, and we've talked about the desert kangaroo rat being so amazing that it can actually, it doesn't have to drink water because it can make water from that metabolic water that breaks down by eating seeds and carbohydrates. So it's pretty neat. Maybe a little bit of moisture from, you know, some of the seeds, but generally it doesn't have to drink if they put it into an experimental chamber. So that's pretty neat. You might have, anybody ever raised rabbits in a cage? Rabbit raising? No. Sometimes they reheat their pellets, you know, their poop, right? But it's not so much for the moisture. They can get more nutrients out of it. They pass it one time. We'll talk about that when we get into GI. But sometimes if you raise rabbits, you don't want the cage where all the little pellets go out. In nature, they'll actually re-eat their poop again because it's already broken down one time, and it helps the digestion from the grass. The second time they eat it, they can get more nutrients out of that grass. It's not so much for the water. People kind of got confused with that in the past when we talked about it. It's for the nutrients. If you look at animals that are hydrated, you're not going to change your temperature so quickly, right? If you're dehydrated and you go into a cold or warm room, you can actually have a body temperature change more. But if you're like a camel, for example, a good example is a camel that's hydrated, that has a lot of water that they can retain, they don't have those daily swings so much in their temperature because that water is like a buffer for the temperature. But if they're dehydrated, their temperature swing will go up and down quicker because they don't have that buffer. So water is actually a temperature buffer as well for animals. And we'll get into some pulling that around on the last part of the course. So after we finish osmoregulation, we talk about GI. And then I think we could, and then there'll be a little bit about kind of pulling everything together. Some of it's kind of gee-whizzy, but it helps bring things together. And then I hope the following Thursday that we spend time really reviewing, but also we have, how many more quizzes do we have after today?
Two
more quizzes. Isn't that great? And you get to drop the lowest two, so that's really good. All right. Okay, so this is the idea of a camel that's hydrated versus one that's, say, a very small animal that doesn't have a lot of water to buffer that temperature. It's going to go up and down in the temperature fluctuations. Okay. So there's a lot, and it doesn't matter what text you're looking about, that for pH in osmoregulation, if it's a GI tract in insects, if it's a kidney in us, or the GI tract in us as well, because your GI tract is very good about absorbing water, but actually it has to get ions across too, right? You don't get ions just by absorbing it through your skin, right? You have to drink it, get it into your GI tract, and it has to get those ions across, right? So your body, your GI tract is very good for ion regulation too, but also for water, right? But you can also get rid of excess water if you're hydrated through your feces as well. So I think you all know if you're really dehydrated, you might have constipation, right? So if you have constipation, what do they tell you to do? Drink a lot of water, make softer poop, right? Feces are softer. And that's just part of it. You can actually hydrate somebody very quickly. Let's say you got a burn somebody that had a very bad burn on their body and their skin's all burned up and they can't get an IV in them. Where might you hydrate them? Yeah, guess where? Up the behind, right? Because the large intestine can absorb water very well. So you could actually save someone's life if they were burned. You can't get IVs in them, for example, or they can't go down, or they might have burn in their mouth for whatever reason, or a caustic burn from chemicals. They can actually hydrate people by putting it in their behind. And there's that crazy things that have happened in the past, like hazing and things like that, by putting alcohol up someone's behind. Very bad, because you absorb alcohol very quickly into your bloodstream, and it spikes real quick. And you get drunk very fast, but then can get a lethal dose very quick, too. If you ever hear of that, it's just kind of gross, but people do crazy things. All right.
Don't play a joke. Don't play a joke.
Yeah, don't do those kind of things. So that's not good. So the point here on these next couple of slides, I don't want to freak you out. I'm just going through to show you examples, but I'm going to highlight a few things that are really interesting later on. But just think about if this is your GI tract, or maybe your kidneys, your nephron that we'll talk about. you can get ions to move across. Most of this is all due to what? Setting up a gradient. The sodium-potassium pump again. That is amazing, right? The sodium-potassium pump, because that can keep that gradient growing. So if you have high potassium inside the cell, it depends what side of the cell might be permeable to potassium. If there are leak channels over here for potassium, the potassium can go out this way. If you're on this side, potassium might come in, but then it can go back out. And there might be a reason for that. We'll talk more about that. It depends on the cell. But the idea here is that you set this gradient up with a pump. And it could be other pumps too, but primarily the sodium-potassium pump. So here we have a cell that's permeable to sodium and potassium on this side. Because of the gradient it's set up, it's going to pull sodium in and potassium to go out. If this is your renal system, if this is your kidney, what's going to happen to this potassium? It's going to get out, right? Urine. And then what happens to your blood potassium over time? Drops, right? So then you become hypokalemic, right? Kalemic. So we always have to kind of think about what's that going to do to the blood if it's you're losing it into the urine. So if we flip through some of these pictures, it's kind of neat to think about. This could be even your GI tract, for example, right? Your stomach. We've talked about what's the primary aspect to hydrate somebody for saving somebody from cholera, right? Where you know, might have diarrhea of 10 liters a day, right? That's a lot. That's a lot that can be lost very quickly, and you'll dehydrate, right? But the primary care is actually glucose with a little bit of salt. Why? Because glucose with salt is a co-transporter, and that can pull sodium and glucose into the cell, and what's going to follow? Water. So then you save someone's life, and then they can get treatment for the cholera later on. So the primary treatment is actually just glucose with some salt, not high levels, but then you can get that co-transport to work and save somebody from dehydrating. Again, it's all set up by what? Sodium potassium pump. Sorry. I don't know who that is. Blood bank. I donate blood. They call me like every 120 days. Somebody works in the blood bank, right? And you know how they call yours on your ready to donate again. Okay, so the idea is not to memorize which sides, but just that this can, it depends on what side is permeable. Now, CO2 in your body, to regulate pH, we're actually talking about metabolic regulation, bicarb, right? And CO2 can go right to the bilipid membrane. If it goes into the cell, like in your kidneys, what can it do? Carbonic anhydrase, it can go either direction, but we see it making bicarb here, right? And bicarb. So out. So the idea is that if it went the other direction, out into the urine, now we can lose bicarb, right? So it just depends what side of the cell. I don't want you to try to memorize these main points of this right now. We're going to talk about two special cells in your kidney later on. Okay. It's the same with the gills for a fish. It's no different, right? Here's the gills of, say, a fish. It's going to be a problem if they lose, or maybe it's the skin of the amphibian, right? It all depends on the permeability of that membrane, or the gills to get rid of excess loss, or maybe even take it up. The idea is that sodium-potassium pump, again, drives that gradient. There's lots of different transporters, antiporters, semiporters. You should probably create one, and it probably exists out there, but there's lots of neat ones that, you know, do things like the sodium, chloride, potassium. There's some that are opposite, like a potassium hydrogen. We just saw a co-transporter of glucose or amino acids in salt, the same idea. Okay, and same kind of things. All right, so we can kind of go through that. Then we're going to talk a little bit more about the mammalian kidney. And the mammalian kidney is really quite amazing. There's so much to it, but some main points to try to remember. So the anatomy, you always got to know the anatomy. Cortex of the kidney. You saw these kidneys in the outreach center when we did that, about this, you know, smaller than your palm of your hand, right? And if you cut them in half, or this way that you can see it, there's two main regions to remember. This outer region is called the cortex, and the inner region, the medullary region, the medulla that's inside. Afferent blood, efferent coming out, and then this collecting place for urine, then goes out through the ureter, and where does that go?
Bladder.
Bladder, and then out the body to the urethra, right? So there's two main nephron types in the mammalian kidney we're going to talk about, and that's the medullary nephrons and the cortex nephrons, or the cortical nephrons. The ones with medullary are the ones that go down really deep. So just think of this one here. It's going to go all the way like that. And the smaller one stays in the cortex region. So smaller one in the cortex region. So that's what they're called, these two different names. And the longer the nephron, Luther Henley, this part that we're going to talk about, the better ability to concentrate urine. So now which kind of nephron do you think the desert kangaroo has, rat has? A cortical nephron or a medullary type of nephrons?
Medullary.
Medullary. Now let's take another rodent from Central America that's in the tropical rainforest, and you look at that rodent where there's a lot of water around it all the time. What type of nephron do you think it has? More of a medullary type. Now if you took the desert kangaroo rat and you move that down to Central America where there's a lot of rain, it would do okay, right? But take that Central American rodent and move that one to the desert. What's going to happen there? Not going to make it, right? Because it can't concentrate its urine that well. It's going to need more water. And this is exactly what you see among the animals that live in these different environments. So you can see that some would be able to concentrate the urine very well. We have both types. So we can make pretty good concentrated urine, and we can make dilute urine as well, depending on our hydration. So some parts to try to remember in here. It's a good thing to take a blank piece of paper and actually draw it out, these parts of the nephron. So this is the individual unit of the kidney. Let's just look at this for a minute and spend a little time with it. So blood's coming in, goes around this capillary bed. This capillary bed's called the glomerulus. So it's a tuft of little blood vessels. It's a tuft of capillaries. Then the blood comes out, and it doesn't go straight into that the renal vein right here. It goes into this network, this paratubial network. So this network of blood vessel after the glomerulus is going around this part of the nephron we haven't talked about yet, but you see this loop, and then the loop goes up here and comes back around, and then it goes into this collecting duct, and then from the collecting duct it empties into this region, and then that region goes into the ureter. Okay, so this paratubial capillary bed is really important because this helps to pull ions out of this region of the nephron and actually for secretion as well. But it actually goes around this loop of Henle, and you see which direction it's going, this way, and then back up, and then out to the venous exit of the renal vein. But it's really important, this vasa recta part of the blood vessel too, because it takes up the excess fluid that's around this region of the kidney. If this vasa recta is not here, it can't take away, it can't have the sink of pulling the salts out and the water out that has been reabsorbed from the nephron. So the nephron can't really function that well if it can't remove all these excess salts and water that's setting up the concentration gradient in the interstitium. All right, so glomerulus, paratubial capillary network, vasa recta is not the loop of Henle. Vasa recta is the blood vessels around the loop of Henle, and then out. All right. If we talk about the nephron, which we're going to go more into detail in a little bit, we have this little capsule around that capillary bed called Bowman's capsule, named after the guy that described it. Then we have what's called the proximal tubule. And we'll go over this again. Proximal tubule, descending loop of Henle. And then there's two ascending loops, ascending regions. The thin ascending, you see it's really thin. And then the thick ascending loop here. And then this is the distal tubule, or the distal convoluted tubule. You can use it interchangeably, distal convoluted tubule. And it's really important that you see this right here. It actually goes right back by the glomerular tuft. And we're going to talk about this right here, because this is what... it's actually there's cells there that can monitor the urine. It can monitor the sodium that's being made in this urine. This urine we call primary urine. So it's primary urine. And then after it leaves this region, it's in the rest of the distal tubule, and then it dumps in the collecting duct. And this collecting duct collects from all the different nephrons. So you see the regions where it would collect from.
So the cortical nephron is the same way, just, you know, arranged in a shorter dimensions. And again, there's the little distal tubule going right by the glomerulus right there. So there's something very important about that region that we're going to talk about in a little bit. All right, so the way is to increase surface area for absorption and secretion is inside of that nephron is increasing that surface area, just like your GI tract. How do you do that? Well, you increase that surface area by having that cell make those little fingers and increase that surface area. So now you have a very large surface area for every cell, right? And on those little fingers of that cell are all these pumps and exchangers and transporters. And look at all the mitochondria. What does that tell you? There's a lot of action going on in that cell, right? Because there's a lot of mitochondria. If you didn't see a lot of mitochondria in that cell, then you might think, not so many active processes, maybe more passive processes. So depending on where you took a section across that nephron, you could pretty well, you know, estimate maybe what's going on in the sense of keeping that ATP pump going on. Okay. So this is important, this region here, because the flow that's coming into the glomerulus, it can be regulated. It can be regulated by smooth muscle cells that are around that afferent arteria. So if it pinches down, what's going to happen? Decreased blood flow, right? If it extends out, it can increase blood flow. So it can increase the amount of urine being made. If it clamps down, what happens to the pressure on the other side? What's going to happen in the glomerular tuft? The pressure on the other side. If you clamp here, if you pinch the garden hose off, how much water is going to come out the other side? Not much, right? So it can decrease the hydrostatic pressure on this side, back pressure that way, right? So think about how to regulate that pressure in there. And then it goes through and then goes off to the network, capillary bed. But this little capsule, this little region, you can think of it almost like a coffee filter. This isn't like the spleen, but this is like a coffee filter in the sense that it doesn't want large molecules to go through. It wants water and small ions, but not the coffee grounds, right? So if we think about that process, then that can help us out. All right, so we're going to stop here in a minute and take a quiz. But just kind of go through it. Look at these slides. There's not much to it, but the idea is that increased surface area, you can then reabsorb. And if you have pumps, then you get surface areas. You can secrete compounds into the urine also from the blood, not just filter. So you can get filter, but you can also secrete into the urine. Okay? And we'll talk about these pressures online. So what I'm going to do is to pass out a little quiz. All right. And so if you put up your notes, especially put up the